This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
In the beginning, Guy and I often wondered if we were having any real impact, and we did a school the week of that decision, and it was another one that was like Chewett Hill. They just knew the whole catalogue, and Guy just walked up to me and he goes, "This is our yes world. We're living in a yes world."
Kaya, and welcome to Season 2 of Songlines, an RTFM podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. I'm Cesara Kadishnaz, an actor, writer, director and lover of all things art. And over six episodes spanning the Noongar seasons, we will hear from artists across music, dance, theatre and photography and walk the emotional, historical and spiritual paths which have shaped them into the creatives they are today. It is so good to be back for another year of the CBAA award-winning series. We have such an incredible cast of Indigenous artists this year, and I am so excited to kick things off this Bunuru with musician and Noongar language champion Gina Williams. Gina's work recognises one of the most beautiful and rare languages on the planet, Noongar language of the southern coast of WA. Alongside her musical partner, Guy Gauss, the three-time Rammy Award-winning duo have also taken their talents and knowledge to schools across the state, making it their mission to connect people to Noongar culture and rewrite historical narratives through song. She is an absolute musical and cultural gem of WA, and I cannot wait to share this chat with you. This is Gina Williams, and we're in Bunuru. And we are back. I'm so excited today to be joined in the studio by, she's going to hate it when I say this, but one of my absolute idols, Gina Williams. Oh. Ask anyone how much I, like how I talk about you, and they will, every single one will confirm that fact. Oh. But I tell you, I've been so excited to interview you.
Really?
Oh my God. I don't know if like, when you say dad's one of your, you are one of my favourite people. Every time I see you perform, I cry.
Oh, and then
I go and have a crisis to Dad or Kobe about it. Like the very first time I saw you perform in Denmark, I was like, Kobe, introduce me to her, please.
Oh, Kobe. Sweetie.
Anyway.
You really need to get out more. I'm so unremarkable.
No. You are. I'll save
I'm
the
really
gushing.
Really not. Spend all that time. You spend any amount of time with me, see how very, very ordinary I am.
Well, like, everyone's ordinary, but it's the fact that, like, you've made this whole career out of performing in language and just working with language, and you do it so beautifully, and it's just...
Oh, look at you.
This podcast spans the Noongar seasons, and today we find ourselves in Bunuru, or in the second summer. It's a hot time of year and also a social time of year. What memories do you have of this season? What do you love about this season?
Oh, well, what I love about this season, as a very, very little girl, we had no air conditioning in our house, mm-hmm. and so Mum and Dad would put blankets and towels up against the windows, and they World Series cricket had come to Australia, and my parents were glued to the television, and I was their remote control.
The job of the child.
Yeah, and they would they'd watch the cricket during the day, and I'd slowly go up the walls with boredom. But
valid.
What was really beautiful was that at the end of the day, when the sea breeze would come in, Mum and Dad would take the covers down from the windows, and as the sun went down, they'd put a blanket out on the front lawn. And, you know, we didn't have a lot. We had a little black and white TV, but we had a record player that stacked records. Mm. And so you could get six albums on this record player, and Mum and Dad would choose three records each. And Mum would listen to country music, Dad would listen to jazz, and the people he said really knew how to sing. although I think that a lot of country singers really know how to sing as well. But we would sit, and while the house would cool down, we would sit outside, and Mum, you know, we'd sit on, I'd be on this blanket and Dad, with Mum and Dad, and it was there that I met Billy Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
And the story goes that I wanted to be Sarah Vaughan when I grew up, and I wanted to marry Nat King Cole. And, and from his lawn chair, my dad used to conduct the Glenn Miller Band.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was a really magical, very beautiful memory of this time of year when it was too hot to be outside during the day and then too hot to be inside during the evening. So it was a really... And music played a really big part in that. I was told as a child that I had no aptitude for music. So I've never had any music lessons, never had any singing lessons. But I learnt to sing in that time by listening to people who really knew how to.
Oh, that's such a beautiful memory. It's one of those memories that you read about in books or see in movies with the montage music.
Yeah, like, that's the one.
Like over the top.
Yeah, and Dad would go, shh, can you hear that? Hear that? That's how you sing. That's how you do it. And I'd be like, you know, and I'd really crane to listen. And, yeah, I loved it. I came to really love and appreciate music because I realised that it's more than just a physical exercise. Mm. You have to be connected. You have to understand and really believe what you're singing. And the great singers do that effortlessly. They do that really, really well.
Oh, I could just listen to you talk for ages, honestly.
You know, I got my start in radio, in
really?
Community radio, actually. My second foster dad, he used to broadcast to be one of the announcers for the Māori program. And so he would speak Māori and he would write out in English what he was saying in Māori and I would read the English. And we used to do that every Wednesday night on Curtin Radio. Like community radio actually plays a really significant and important part in not just our media voice but also our community voice.
So that kind of leads into the next question, which is who's your mob and where do you grow up?
That's a very good question. So my birth name is Laurel Lee Yaron. I'm named after my Auntie Laurel and my Auntie Lena.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, in spite of being the most beautiful child on the planet, my mum gave me up for adoption and I was adopted by Faye and Cyril Williams. And I first of all grew up in Caranup in Perth. And my parents separated when I was a little girl. My mum was sick. She had an addiction to alcohol. And we now know that that's a sickness. So they separated when I was about 10, and then my dad passed away after my 12th birthday. So I was placed in a foster home, and then I was placed in a second foster home, and then I got out while I still knew everything. But I went and found my family as an adult, found my biological family, and discovered that I... Baladong Getcha, with connection to Wadjuk, Wadandi... and Goreng in the southwest. But my grandmother was Gitcha. She was removed as a four-year-old from Mullabulla Station in the East Kimberley, marched as a four-year-old to Derby, put on a boat and brought down to Karalup Mission, eventually taken to Moore River Native Settlement, where she met my grandfather. And, of course, you know, he was a Noongar man. And so the rest is kind of history.
Yeah.
So that's who I am. Where I'm from, who my mob is.
The, like, first question that's always asked whenever you meet another edition.
What's your name? Where are you from? Where's your mob? Yeah, and you know what? It's a great question because this is how we establish rapport with each other.
Mm, yeah.
If we're not related to you, we might know someone that you are related to, and that's how we make connections. I love that about our community. It's never about what separates us. It's always about what connects us. And I think, you know, in terms of connecting ourselves to each other, it's a really beautiful way of doing that.
I was thinking about it recently that kind of is one of the most beautiful things about it, and that kind of constant because obviously so many of us are still figuring out who we're related to and asking family members, and there's this kind of common understanding of that. It's like, okay, so we're not related, but I might know someone who you are related to, and we can sort this out.
Absolutely, yeah, and it doesn't just extend to Noongar. That's wherever you go. Mm. I mean, I found myself as a young journalist over in Sydney, of all places, and walking down a street. I didn't know because I wasn't familiar with Sydney, but we were doing a report on something, and I found myself in a street that wasn't the nicest street in the nicest neighbourhood, and mobs started coming out. And this older lady walked out and she signalled to me to come over. So I walked over to her and she goes, "You're not from around here, are you?" And I went, "No." And she goes, "Who's your mob?" And I went, "I'm Nyunga, I'm from Perth." And she goes, "Oh, who's your family? Who's your mummy and daddy?" And I started to explain it. And then she goes, oh, are you related to such and such? And I was like, "Actually, I am." And she goes, "Oh, darling, come and have a cup of tea with us. You got to meet my family." And so, you know, there was this really beautiful moment where I found myself completely lost and then I was found. And it was a really amazing thing. And I think that that's something that our community does really, really well.
Yeah. It is one of my favourite things.
Mm.
About it in general.
Yeah.
I don't even have much to say to your responses because your responses are just so lovely that I'm like, yes, continue on.
Oh, darling, it's getting me to shut up. That's the trick usually.
Oh, no, Sorry, Mark. Ask my dad or anyone in my family. So you talk about how much you have always loved music and how it's always been so important to you. How did it turn into your career? Because I think it happened a bit later in life.
Yeah, it happened completely by accident. So in a previous life, I worked as a journalist. Mm-hmm. For those that have a really, really good memory, I worked for GWN, which is our regional broadcaster, on a program called Milbindi, which told the positive stories of the achievements and aspirations of our community right across Western Australia. It was only ever meant to be a pilot program. By the time I joined the team, we were doing 40 half-hour episodes a year on commercial television.
Oh, wow.
We were doing news programs on radio three times a week. We were doing a community news broadcast twice a week on television. So there was basically presence, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander presence on either radio or television through GWN 6 days a week. I was really, really proud of that.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and it was before it became something that was fashionable. It was, you know, long before people were turning it into policy documents. And I was very privileged to be part of it. And I realise that now. At the time, it was a really cool, fun and exciting thing to be able to tell, you know, great stories and let mob actually talk about the way that they saw themselves. So I did that for 10 years. I filed over 1,000 stories. And one day I woke up and I thought, you know, it's time to do something different. I need to make space for other people because I could keep doing this, but what I'm doing is I'm actually holding a spot that someone who is more talented, more ambitious, you know, and is really hungry for this. All I've done is shown that it's possible.
Yeah.
And so I stepped off.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very sudden decision and one that I've never regretted. I've always thought, you know, I feel very privileged to have done what I did, but I'm glad that I'm out of it now. And then not long after that, my family, we moved back to Perth. I did a brief stint for Channel 7 on a tourist show called Our WA, which was a lot of fun. And then the work just kind of stopped and I remember thinking, oh, gosh, what am I going to do now? And someone much smarter than me said, why don't you do something with music? Because you're always singing and you're always making up songs. And I had this little kind of file that was full of songs that I'd just made up in my head, and my friend Tiffany Garvey, who's a brilliant photographer now, she was writing poetry at the time, and so we just kind of started writing songs, and I entered what is now the Wham Song of the Year, but at the time it was the West Australian Song Contest, and there was in the form it had you could tick a box and pay the fee and they would give you feedback on your songs. And I thought, well, these guys would know if I'm okay as a songwriter or they might be able to point me in the direction being able to write songs. So, because remembering also that I can't read music and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm making stuff up as I go along. So we found there was a young fella who could play a bit of guitar. We sat in front of a tape recorder. This is how far back it's going. Sat in front of a tape recorder, and I knocked out five songs, and that was fine. And then I entered, ticked the box, and then didn't give it a second thought. And then a few weeks later, my phone rang and someone said, "Is that Gina?" I said, "Yes." And they went, "We're from the WA Music Industry Association, and we're wondering if you would like to come and sing at our awards night." And I thought someone was playing a trick. And I was like, "Are you sure?" And they went, "Yeah." And I went, "I think you've got the wrong person." And I'm like, no, you entered the contest. I went, "Yeah." "You entered five songs?" "Yes." "Well, three of your songs are across some categories. You're a finalist with three of your songs." And so, okay, I'll come and sing. So this young chap and I, we went and I invited everybody, my family and everyone.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because I needed to have mob in the audience so that I didn't feel shame. I could sing to them, and my mum was there and all these people were there. And anyway, I won.
You won?
I won. I won this category. And it was hilarious. I walked out with a check. And it was, and that was on the Friday night. And then on the Monday morning, my phone rang and this person goes, "Is that Gina? We're just wondering if you'd like to come and sing at this event we've got. We can only afford to pay you." "Pay me? Pay me?
Pay me what?
What? You mean I can get paid for this?" They were like, "You can only afford this much." And it was like more than I would ever expect to sing, to get paid to sing. So I just kind of bounced around doing that for a while, but just feeling like Cinderella at the ball. And that just kind of, it just went from there. I've never really looked back. I've never really stopped. And then I started working with Guy Gauss and,
How did that come about?
I was living in Melbourne. He was living in, he was moving to Perth. He was in, and a really dear friend and one of my heroes, one of my idols, a woman named Lorray Coffin, and a friend. She was putting together an event up in Broome, and Guy was the musical director of the house band. Now, just to go back slightly, I was a fan of his group Desert Child. He was in a duo called Desert Child, and they are the most phenomenal guitarists you're ever likely to find. And so all the way from Melbourne to Perth, I was freaking out and just thinking, "I've made a huge mistake. I've made a huge mistake." Anyway, we get to Perth and I jump on the plane to fly to Broome, and suddenly Guy Gauss is standing there walking down the to get into his seat, and I'm sitting there just going, "Be cool. Just be cool.
I know the feeling.
Be cool. Be cool." Right? And he sees me, he goes, "Hey, Gina!" Like this. I was like, "Oh, my God.
Guy Gauss knows who I am.
Anyway, so we had this very brief conversation, and then we just kind of connected up in Broome, and then we were flying back. He was flying back to Perth and I was flying over to Melbourne. He goes, "Look, I'm moving to Perth. He'd either moved to Perth or he was in the process of moving." Mm-hmm. And he said, "If you have any gigs in Perth and you need someone, just sing out, feel free." So Melbourne didn't work out, and so we found ourselves back in Perth, and I got rung for gigs. And the first time I called, it took me 2 days to work up the courage to call him, because I was thinking, he's not going to work with me. He's Guy Gauss. He can work with anybody. He's amazing. And so after 2 days I thought, well, you know what? No is not the worst thing he can say to me, because I can always try and find somebody. He might be able to recommend somebody else. And so I rang him up. "Gina, it's great to hear from you. How are you?" "Good. I've got a gig." "Oh, do you need a guitarist?" "Yeah." "Cool. I'm in." Okay.
Your Guy impression is incredible, by the way.
I've stood next to him long enough. I was like, "That's great. Yes. No worries." So we just started. Our first gig was a Carols by Candlelight. And people thought we were busking. We were being paid. And so everyone was trying to put money in our hands and throw money into his guitar case. It was really funny. But it was like Christmas Carol's one of my favourite things now, because that's where we first started working together. And then we were doing this this project called Healing Songs, Alan Country, and it was about helping mob make sense of their stories through music. Mm. And so we went out and Guy was like, you know, you'd be in the car for 4 hours at a time, and he'd be like, "Hey, you know what you should do? You should write songs in language," because I just started learning language. I was like, "Gaussy, I can't get people listening to me in English. Like, who's going to listen to me in language? Because there were very few speakers that were known of at the time. He goes, man, trust me. If you write language songs the way you write English songs, people are going to listen. I was like, you reckon? He goes, yeah. Give it a go. Anyway, I was like, nah. At home, trying to write language songs. And so I had a couple of language songs. Ended up in the UK on another amazing adventure.
Gosh, look at you go.
I know. You never credit it, hey. It's. I look back and I just think at some point someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and go, actually, there's been a mistake. But no one ever has. I think that's the beautiful thing about this life is that, you know, you never know where you're going to end up. And it's good to surround yourself with people who don't tell you why you can't do something, who will ask you, well, why not? I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah.
I've kind of had that myself. You know, my dad was always, go for it. Like, you don't want to die not knowing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went to the UK and I was in a jazz club. And I was singing jazz standards because that's what my dream was. And people were polite. And then I thought, you know, there's millions of people that would be walking through these doors. There would be thousands of people that would be singing on this stage. And I'm just like every single one of them.
Yeah.
There's no difference. What is the point of difference? And so I stopped what I was doing and I went, all right, you mob, my name is Gina Williams. I'm from Perth, Western Australia. It's one of the most isolated cities in the world. And I'm learning a language, my language, and it's a very rare language. And, you know, there's 40,000 Noongars, but only a couple of hundred speakers of this language left. And so I wrote this song about my dad who taught me to sing by listening. And I'm going to sing it for you now. So I sang this song and it went dead silent. And I thought,
oh no,
I broke it. And then people started clapping and coming up to me at the end going, I don't know what you were singing. My heart just knows it was something good. And I took that and I went home with a couple more songs that I'd written while I was in the UK and came home and went and picked Guy up. We're going out for healing songs. And he's like, how was it? And I was like, oh, man, I've got to write songs in language. He goes, I told you so. And I was like, it was just, I laughed at him at first. And then he goes, can I help you? And I was like, I don't want to do this with anybody else. You're the only person in the world that understands this.
Yeah.
And so we just, that was 2012. And we've never looked back. Never looked back. Every time I've thought, nah, Gowsy, that's a bit too ambitious. That's too much, you know. We need to pull up. But people have just been really beautiful and embraced us and really loved us. And I think, you know, when you hear our hearts in this, my heart is towards my community and my heart is towards this language and not seeing this language fall over.
Mm.
And music, I mean, Noongar language is the most beautiful language on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's entirely singable. So for us, it's always about bringing dignity and integrity and presenting it in a way that is compelling. You want to hear more and you want to hear what the stories are and you want to learn the language. And I think that makes it really beautiful.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you might like to check out others on offer at RTRFM.
Like the award-winning podcast Songlines, chart-topping Sovereign, First Pressing, Mortgage Mag and Favourites Movie Squad.
Plus, don't miss the wild orbit of Planet Perth with Jeff Bullen, tune in to Australian melodrama with Libby Noble and meet local authors on Between the Lines with Danielle Raphael.
Head to rtrfm.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to explore on your home of alternative stories, RTRFM.
Was it daunting when you started learning language?
Yeah, man.
Performing in language?
Yeah, like, man.
Like,
oh my goodness. You got no idea. Oh, it's terrified.
It's so scary.
Well, I went to TAFE to begin with to learn language. That was the only way that I could learn it was to go to this TAFE course. My daughter found it in the newspaper, cut it out and said, you need to go to this. I was like, thank you, daughter. You're a good girl. And I walked up to the thing, and I'm not lying. It was out at Heathcote, which was creepy. And I walked into this building and there was two bits of A4 paper stuck on the wall with signalling where to go for the classes. Now, if you turned left, you went to Feng Shui. If you turned right, to go to Noongar language. I'm not kidding. I stood there for a minute and I thought about it. And then I went to the Noongar class And I walked in. I was the only Noongar in the class, and I thought, oh, this is embarrassing. Oh, don't. So I just walked up to the back and sat down, and this our teacher, Marinda Hansen.
Oh, I love Marinda.
She's so beautiful.
She's so
She walked in with a real serious face, looking at everybody, eyeballing everyone, going, why are you here? Like this. And, of course, you know, I thought I could have just been, you know, be cool. Nah. Oh, I don't know why I'm here. Shame job. I have to come to the classroom to learn my own language. I should have grown up with it, but I didn't. And, chew, I'm so embarrassed and blah, 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 blah. And I should have gone to Feng Shui and I was never a good student and I hated school and here I am back at school. What kind of a joke is that? This is a sick world we live in. I tell you, I'm in the wrong movie right now. And she just kind of looked at me. And then this lady sitting next to me, she put her hand on my arm. She goes, oh, it's all right, darling. That's not your shame. That's ours. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then Miranda goes, so why are you here? And without even thinking, I went, because I want to sing my language. I want to write songs and language. And she just kind of nodded. And then we got on with the class. And I didn't give it a second thought until the next week when I turned up. She was like, Claire, yuck, where's my song? And that happened the next week. And then the next week I thought, well, geez, I better write a song, you know. So I wrote a little lullaby. I was pregnant at the time. I wrote a little lullaby for my son called Iggy's Lullaby, which was on our first album.
I think I've heard you play that before,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, my son hates the song for the record. He absolutely hates it, which is hilarious. I know. But anyway, so I did that. And then the next song I wrote was Wonju. And
now
course,
that song has blown
Yeah, it grew legs and flew in ways that I never expected. But it's beautiful, and I'm really, again, this is the love of the village. You know, we've reached over 1 million kids with that. We see up to 3,000 children a week who all know it and do 100 schools incursions a year thanks to this little song that's been very good to us. And in more recent times, we've set it free and let people, like people have come back with translations of it. So,
really?
You know, yeah, it's sung in Walpuri, it's sung in Mulngana, it's sung in lots of different First Nations languages. I've got a video of it being sung in a room that's on an alp, and the people are singing it in French. There's a German version of it. There's a Spanish version of it. There's a there's a Japanese version of it. So it's really, like, it's just one of those really happy, beautiful love songs that's, doing its own thing now.
So we can't really talk about you and Guy without talking about the fact that you guys have written not just one, but two operas entirely in Noongar. So you were commissioned for the first time for Kulbari Wer Warong.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
It's during the pandemic, the West Australian Opera. Mm. I know, like, I knew Chris Van Chunen, I've known him for a long time. And he reached out and said, can we have a coffee? And so we met. And he goes, look, the short story is we want to offer you a commission to write an opera. And Guy and I both just went, you sure? and I said, because I'd never been to an opera.
Hmm.
And I was like, I don't know if we've got it in us. And he goes, why? And I went, well, because, well, it's not going to sound like an opera. He goes, yeah, that's cool. Okay. And I'm going to make everyone sing in Noongar. He goes, well, we already sing in a dozen other languages. I was like, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, what do you think opera is? And I was like, well, I reckon it's, you know, the big woman with the big, you know, with the helmet with the horns, and she takes a fortnight to die. And and he was like, he goes, oh, that's okay. I can get that kind of assessment. He goes, but you know what it is actually? Opera is Italian for work. It's a work.
Mm.
So it's passionate storytelling with beautiful music. And Guy and I looked at each other and went, oh, we can do that. And, you know, so he was like, you know, it's a youth work. So we were like, all right. So we had 50 kids on stage with us in the premiere of the work.
Wow.
And it was amazing. And it's still touring. We've traveled with it since 2021. And, you know, it's amazing to see kids light up and singing language, and they're doing it like it's just an ordinary, normal thing to do. My son was in – actually, my son's been in both the operas. My daughter was in the second one. Actually, she was in the first one and the touring work as well. But it's just been – you know, so they offered us a second commission about a month after the first one premiered in Perth. We thought that we would fly under the radar. We thought that people would go, oh, it's opera and it's a youth work, so it's not for us. But we sold out. The Coolbardie season sold out. It was huge.
Yeah,
there was so much attention on it.
Yeah, I couldn't get to see it. Didn't even see the first one.
Well, for what it's worth, Guy and I have never seen it either because we're in it, so you never get to really see it.
True. Yeah.
What was really funny was on the sort of the week leading up to the actual premiere of the work, because Guy and I, we always stand together on stage. He's always next to me, and it's never like I feel brave when I'm standing next to him, because it's a scary. I still get very anxious and very nervous. I've stopped vomiting, but I used to wind myself up so much I'd be physically ill. And when we first started, not everyone loved what we did when we first started. But I think, like I said, once people see our hearts, they realise that we're not doing it for any other reason than trying to present a love offering to our community.
Yeah.
So he had to go down into the pit and I had to stay up on stage.
No.
And I just went, actually, I don't think I can do this. And the director's like, what do you mean you can't do this? You're on for the first 20 minutes of the show. You kind of have to do this. So what we ended up doing was piping his guitar through the fold back, and it came in through the ceiling so I could just hear him. And he had the same. He had a fold-back speaker in the pit so he could hear me.
Yeah.
And we just kind of worked off each other and the orchestra. Beautiful Dr. Chris Stone, who did all the orchestrations for both the operas, he actually wrote Coolbardie so that it didn't matter what Guy played, the orchestra would wrap around his guitar playing. Because that's how we write. Everything. You can hear it with a 60-piece orchestra, you can hear it with a band, 5-piece band, or you can hear it with just me and Guy, just a guitar and a voice, and it all works. It has to be. It has to work that way first, because it has to be about the language. It has to be about honouring the stories through the language.
Well, just branching from the operas very briefly, just talking about the two of you performing, like I've seen you guys perform 3 or 4 times, something like that now, over the last couple of years. And, like, my favourite thing about it, other than obviously the singing and language and the crying and, you know, like anyone who's, like, I think I went the second time I saw you in Denmark, I was watching you with a friend of mine and it was about 8 counts in and my friend turned to me and she's like, are you already crying? And I was like, no. But it's so beautiful watching the two of you perform together, because you can tell that you've been doing it for so long and are just like best friends at this point in time, and it, like, that in itself is just so incredible to watch. It's part of the show in a way, like it's part of what makes it so incredible.
Yeah, it's a really special partnership, and it doesn't work, one doesn't work without the other. And I feel very, I think, you know, these kinds of relationships and friendships are, they call them once in a lifetime. Yeah. And I feel like I've waited my whole life for Guy. Recently we were invited to play Under the Same Sun as part of the closing concert for the Festival of Perth, which is a huge privilege. And at the time, Iggy, he rang and he said, you know, if you could work with anybody in the world, who would you want to work with? And, of course, the hamsters in my head all jumped on the bus and drove to Disneyland.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, the possibilities. Mm. And I love everybody because I love music. So who would I love to work with? And it was really interesting because, you know, Mudakic worked with Angelique Kidjo, who's incredible. Fluent worked with Sampa the Great.
Yes.
And that was a phenomenal combination. We had beautiful Emma Donovan with her real mama voice, soul mama, working with Mama Kin. Which was really amazing and fantastic. Jessica Hitchcock, who was our Willera in Wondigan Willera, she sang with Paul Kelly.
Yeah.
It was like this extraordinary lineup. Gina, who would you like to work with? I want to work with Guy Gauss. I just want to work with Guy Gauss.
Yeah.
You can put anyone else in front of us, but for what we do, it doesn't work with anyone else.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, you know, and I tried to explain that on stage, and instead I said a whole stack of other things that I didn't really mean. Well, I didn't. I meant it, but I didn't mean
Wasn't the thing you wanted to say.
Wasn't quite ready to make these big, broad announcements. Anyway, those that were there would know. But I feel very grateful to work with him. I'm really incredibly privileged to have someone who has the same soundtrack in their head as me. I still can't read music, and I'm not very good at explaining what's going on in my brain, and yet he has this remarkable gift and ability to be able to tease out what's going on in my head in a way that doesn't, it never makes me feel silly or less than. It never makes me feel inadequate. He always makes me feel like we've got this.
Which is such a big thing, because so many of the pieces you write are so personal.
Yeah.
And come from places that have been quite painful, and putting that in front of an audience and being like, okay.
Being vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. That's terrifying.
It is. And, you know, it's taken us a really long time to build that little bubble around us, and that translates off stage as well. We keep ourselves very contained.
Yep.
You know, our circle is incredibly small, but if you're in it, you're in our circle for life.
Yeah.
And I think there's something really beautiful and really powerful about that, because it means that I know that I can trust him implicitly and he can trust me. One of our things that we do, we always hug each other either before a gig or, you know, first thing in the morning, give each other a hug and go, you know what, you and me and the rest of the world. And I think, and you would know this as an artist, you have to be able to trust people, those around you, because ever going to be as good as that relationship.
God, yeah. It's like the biggest thing when you're rehearsing a play, especially one that's quite intense. Like I remember, you know, doing Hackett, that 8-week rehearsal process was so important, because obviously not only we needed it for the language, but just so we all could fully trust each other and lean on each other, because there is this added vulnerability. For being a performer, is vulnerable in general, but then you add this layer of speaking in a language that got torn from you.
Yep.
It's this whole other.
And when you start to wake up a language that's been asleep in this place, there's all kinds, it conjures up a whole stack of other things emotionally and spiritually as well. So we always need to be able to trust those around us to have us and to help us to hold that space as well.
I think you guys as well have been through your work with schools have, like, I remember my old primary school performed Wanju. I think it was Wanju and I think another song. All I know is that I knew all the words.
And what primary school were you
at? Tuitt Hill Primary School.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
That's my old primary school.
Oh, my
school.
Goodness. So we did a workshop there.
Yeah.
Were you there when we... Oh, no, you'd be too...
No.
Wouldn't be young enough for that. But we did this... Not that you're not young. You're definitely a baby, darling. We did Tuitt Hill is one of the most memorable schools that we ever did.
Really?
Oh, my God. I think I just stood there and cried for the duration, because the kids knew all the songs.
Yeah, that quite...
The teacher is amazing.
Yeah.
And the school was incredible. And I've never, you know, in the beginning, Guy and I often wondered if we were having any real impact. And I think when you stand in front of these kids and you hear them singing your songs back to you, you realise that actually, you know, it doesn't feel like it some days. It doesn't feel like you're making a difference, but don't stop, because you just never know the seeds that you sow.
I remember when I was watching them and stood up on the benches, because I was never allowed to do that as a student. As an adult, I could. And I just remember, like, getting so emotional, because when I was at school, I didn't even realise Noongar language
was a thing,
right? And then here I was back there almost, actually it would have been like 10 years later, to see them all singing in language by one of my favourite artists, just so proudly, and like, you guys have played such a massive part in that, in, because you can imagine all those little Noongar kids going to school and then getting to learn it.
Well, we saw when we first started, you'd see the Noongar kids going, because I always, Kaya Korlangangang, Gina, Nijibo, going, Alak, Jerupin, Noonuk, Dilang, Alak, Jerupin, Nijibuji, Yiriak, and Kaya, wah! You know, hello, boys and girls, I'm Gina, this is Guy, we're so happy to see you, we're so happy to be standing here in this space, and, you know, wala, woohoo! And you'd see the Noongar kids, they'd go, oh, don't, like this, and then, more recently, yeah, the kids, they tap each other and go, and then they puff up and they go, that's my language, you know, and you think, and they love telling you that they're Noongar. And I think the funniest one was we had this kid, these kids, when we were doing the opera, these Noongar kids in the cohort come up to me, because I've only just wrapped my head around being called auntie. Right? I keep thinking I'm too young to be someone's auntie. Right? So these kids come up, they reckon, oh, are you my auntie or my nana? Oh, what? No, don't say that. Yeah, who's your mummy? And they're going, oh, my mummy, this is our mummy. And I was like, oh, so who's your nana? And nana's my cousin. I was like, oh, nan. But it's beautiful because these kids now, you know, that they have connection, and the things that were once played down or taken away are things that are given back.
Yeah.
And I love that, because I think, you know, these are the things that I never grew up with, but yeah, I'm seeing it come back with not a vengeance, but with a passion. And yeah, there's this whole, I mean, I know that October was really hard for all of us. Mm. And, you know, we wondered whether or not we were doing the right thing, doing what we do. But we went and we did a school the week of that decision.
Yeah.
And I stood in front of this school, and it was another one that was like Chewett Hill. They just knew the whole catalogue. And Guy just walked up to me and he goes, this is our yes world. We're living in a yes world. And I just thought, he's absolutely right.
Those kids.
So, you know, and that conversation, they've had their say. We don't have to talk about that anymore.
No.
We can just keep living in a yes world where these kids one day are going to rise up and lead a love revolution. And I can't wait to see that.
Absolutely.
I'll be in my nursing home that they will have chosen, and I'll be cheering, you know, and proud and happy, because I think that's where it is. That's where we're at.
Because I've done bits of work with kids in language, and I've thought about it like that, but I've never found the way to word it quite like you have. And it really beautifully leads us in to the last question, which is what we've been asking. It's what we've been asking everybody that has come through. What do you hope for the next generation of First Nations creatives?
What I hope that they take things to the next level. I think, you know, Guy and I are doing things that we never thought possible, but they are possible. And so I want to see people stretch and take it further. I want to see people like you. You know, you're acting and you're on stage and you're directing. And I think you should be doing this around the world, you know, not just here in Perth. You have the skills and the ability where, you know, and actually where it becomes a really ordinary thing. You know, it's not special, and it's not the first. And we put a lot of emphasis on the first. I think what we should be doing is actually working towards the ordinary. Where it actually just becomes something. Oh, that's great.
It's no longer something special anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because it will always be special.
Mm.
In terms of our cultural identity, this is always going to be special. But, you know, I mean, there was the release of the that cultural landscape document by Creative Australia where they, you know, let's treasure First Nations and put First Nations first.
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful thing to do.
Yeah.
But I look at groups like WA Opera, they've been doing that for years. They actually were like, they've made it really normal, and and that's been really evident. It was evident in the second opera where we saw, you know, 25 people on stage singing language and just being the absolute best that they could be, and people in the audience, both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, embracing them and embracing these stories and celebrating them.
Yeah.
And it's very normal to do that. So I think that I would like to see, you know, and I'd like to see First Nations. It'd be lovely to see, you know, something like Yiriyarkin being a state company. You know, where it's, and I don't know, maybe there's opportunities for, and not just on stage, but off stage as well, where there's opportunities for our young people to be doing, you know, working all parts of the arts community as either artists and practitioners or as arts workers.
Yeah.
And not because of quotas, but because this is someone's dream.
It's because they're good.
And they're really good at it.
Yeah.
So that's my hope for the future.
Oh, thank you. It's been such a joy talking to you,
you
today,
too,
Gina.
Darling.
Thank you,
you
so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It's just been lovely. You're the best.
Nah, you know.
A very special thank you to our guest, Gina Williams, for joining me on Songlines. My name is Cesare Krishnaz, and this episode was produced and edited by Danielle Raphael. Our music is by Marakit, with artwork by Wayne Ryder. A big thank you to Kobe Arthur Morrison for his help on this series. Songlines is recorded at RTRFM on the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. We pay our respects to elders past and present. This land was never ceded. My name is Sarah Krishnaz, and next time on Songlines, I'll be catching up with actor Bobby Henry. Buora, catch you next time.